out of one interview.
Help me clarify.
Today. Good morning. It is April 16th. I hope everybody filed their taxes or their amendment to their taxes. And legislators, we needed to get our ethics forms in yesterday, so I hope we're all still here on Monday. We have two things. Yes, it meets occasionally on Monday when you come. Yes. And we have two things on our agenda today, and we're going to start with a couple of people that did not have an opportunity to testify from on community colleges on
last week.
Sunday night. Oh, last week.
Yeah.
And so so I need to open the public hearing.
Open the public hearing on House Bill 5024.
Okay. I'm going to open a hearing on House Bill 5024. Mr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, members, there are two people that were we did not get to when community colleges had public testimony. Tracy Hodson, I hope I got that right or close, because I do butcher names. I apologize. And Joel Fisher. So if you both could come up and...
And then after their testimony, we will have presentations from Mr. Cannon and Mr. Revelo, and Mr. McGee will keep us all in track, and if he doesn't, Mr. Wilson will.
Okay.
Oh, yes, good morning, and please start with your name.
Yeah. Good morning, co-chairs Comp, Ann Monroe, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tracy Hodson. You pronounced it perfectly, actually. That doesn't happen often. I live in Portland, Oregon. I'm a history instructor at Chemeketa Community College in Salem. I'm president of the Chemeketa Faculty Association and secretary of the Oregon Education Association Community College Council. I speak today in support of funding community colleges in Oregon at the $550 million level or higher. If you want an education that has the most transformative power in the shortest amount of time, you should prioritize funding for community colleges. Our state's poorest, most disadvantaged students turn primarily to community colleges to get a chance at a better life. Many students are from working class or immigrant families where no one's gone to college. Many are turning their lives around from a drug addiction, an abusive relationship, or a prison sentence. Many are preparing for or changing careers in the hopes of improving the lives of their families. These are young single mothers, divorcees, or soldiers who have completed their military careers. In 1 or 2 years, students can get a GED that will open up a whole range of jobs that weren't open for them before. In 1 or 2 years, they can gain English language skills that will do the same, allow them to have many more opportunities for jobs. In 1 or 2 years, they can be transformed into highly skilled graduates of career technical programs such as welding, auto mechanics, nursing, dental assisting, business technology, and more. They can literally go from having no salary to making $60,000 a year. In 1 or 2 years, they can also gain the academic confidence they need to pursue more expansive educational goals. So these students constitute the future of our state. Many of them grew up in your communities, and they're planning on spending their whole lives in your communities. So your decision now on community college funding will determine not only the opportunity they have, but also what your community can do with its for a brighter future. So please keep working on finding the additional investment to stabilize community college funding with a $550 million allocation. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Chair Comp, Chairman Rowe, members of the committee, my name is Joel Fisher with Oregon Business Association. We're a statewide association with members all across Oregon, big and small. I'm here with a letter that you should have before you, also from some of the other major statewide business associations, including Associated Oregon Industries, the Portland Business Alliance, and the Oregon Business Council. Collectively, we represent over, we think by our best guesstimates, over 3,000 companies across Oregon. We're here to testify in support of a strong community college budget. Tell you a bunch of things that you probably already know. The community colleges are the economic engines of a lot of Oregon. We, along with a lot of other people in this building, have really put sort of a magnifying glass on rural Oregon. You'll recall the economic analysis that we were getting from last year showing is that Oregon is pulling out of the recession. We're doing pretty well. until you separate out Portland from rural Oregon. Portland's doing even stronger. Rural Oregon's just holding steady, or some areas even still in decline. And the community colleges are really at the forefront of economic development here in Oregon. They're at the forefront of connecting our education to careers. They're responsive with businesses and providing training for our workforce. And workforce was the number one issue, as I'm sure I've probably testified before this committee, and if not, you've heard me in front of other committees talk about the rural tour that we embarked on this summer. We went all around the state to 17 different communities, talking with local business leaders, local economic development people, local education leaders there, and workforce was the number one issue that came up across the state. There are lots of jobs out there. There's not a skilled workforce to meet them, which is why we're here to testify in support of a strong community college budget. Restoring both the universities and community college budgets to pre-recession funding levels, ensuring education outcomes by focusing resources towards completion, high-demand degrees and certificates, and increasing investment in and revamping the Oregon Opportunity Grant to maximize access to higher education. So here to urge your support. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Any questions for these two people? Co-Chair Monroe.
Well, thank you for your testimony. Both of you sound like you've heard some of my speeches. And the 550 figure is rational and reasonable, and I think we can get there.
I hope so.
That is exactly the number that I'm fighting for, mm-hmm. when I converse with the big co-chairs and other leaders in the Senate and the House. It is truly an investment in the future of this state. Yeah. So we will do the best we can. Mm-hmm. Community colleges provide proximity for a lot of students that maybe come from families where they're the first to go to college, or
absolutely,
some other kind of need. It's interesting, you know, you always think about college education, well, you go off somewhere. But the truth of the matter is, for a lot of students, it's much cheaper if they can live at home. And community colleges often provide a proximity to their home. They're within commuting distance. And also, it's easier for students, especially from Eastern Oregon, to travel over into the Valley or to Portland to go to college is a scary thought for a lot of them. But if they have a community college nearby, that's something that they can get their mind and their efforts around and their finances around. So
absolutely,
thank you for your testimony. We're working on it.
Thanks.
The Honorable Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Co-Chair Compton. I'll second Co-Chair Monroe's motion, 550 for
community colleges.
Did we vote on that today?
Not today, but soon.
Senator's been working on that.
Well, we have been.
Okay.
But I appreciate the second, and we'll let the co-chairs know. Okay. Thank you. And yes, your words have been heard, and we're working. Yeah, we really are working.
Thank you.
Mr. Cannon and Mr. Revelo. It is my joy to make sure that we have a little bit of ethnic diversity. When I first started working here after teaching and being administrator in Woodburn, Oregon, I looked around the building for the longest time, my first session, and I just found no brown people, and it's about time. So I welcome you here. And Ben?
Thank you.
Let's do it.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I was afraid you were going to say it was your joy to begin the final day of HEC testimony, or your joy to conclude the HEC testimony. It is our joy to bring our presentation to a close today.
Well, and I was just hoping that Mr. Revelo would do part of his in Spanish, so that
I'm sure he'd be happy to oblige. We are on day 16. It is our final day. We'll be spending a few minutes with Mr. Baez Arevalo's testimony on the unit that he leads, a very important unit for our agency, and then we'll describe really how the agency is organized from a staffing standpoint. We'll give you a glimpse at some of the policy option packages that we've proposed that are related to the sort of staffing and infrastructure for our agency, and then I'll conclude with some final thoughts on where we've been and where we're headed, and then Mr. McGee will wrap it up from the DAS standpoint. So with that, I think you see where we've been and where the way we look as an agency. And with that, I'll
And you have a quiz for Senator Thompson for all the days he missed?
We'd be happy to do that, Madam Chair. Sure. Let me just...
Time just flies.
Before I say a few framing words about the
That's unit, it. I'm not going to pick on you anymore.
A few framing words about the unit that that Juan leads. This is a unit that works primarily with private and proprietary higher education providers in Oregon. It is a fee-funded unit, so there isn't a general fund in this unit to speak of. There has been some. There's less today and even less going forward. This is a unit that the HEC inherited from OSAC and from Oregon Department of Education separately, the private career schools and the Office of Degree Authorization that he'll speak to. Starting in 2012, these were the first portions of the HEC staffing structure, actually. We think now these units are in their right home, and we think they're housed under the right director. So Juan has helped really to stabilize these organizations, move them forward, help protect and advance student interest in Oregon. And with that, I'll turn it over to him.
Thank you, Ben. Good morning, Co-Chair Comp, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Juan Baez Arevalo, and I'm the Director of Private Postsecondary Education for the Oregon Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I didn't prepare my testimony in Spanish, but I'd be certainly glad to engage in a presentation in Spanish and help you all code switch between the languages as we progress. As a former elementary school administrator and central office administrator in school districts, I certainly understand the comments, and I appreciate the welcoming message. It is my great pressure to present to you what I call often the original HEC, and Ben and I talk about this and joke about this. As the units under the Office of Private Postsecondary Education were among the first to be transferred to the commission. And this morning I'll highlight the key responsibilities and functional role of each unit and our small but strategic policy option package.
And excuse me, Juan, for the new members that just came in, we're on day 16 for the HEC overview.
Thank you.
Okay. The Office of Private Postsecondary is comprised of three units, the Office of Degree Authorization, the VA State Approving Agency, or VASAA, and the Private Career Schools Unit. Our common focus is student success, and much of the work of what we do is the regulation and oversight of education providers in our state. It is worth noting that our goal is to make the units self-sustainable through the fees they collect and the federal service contract with the U.S. Veterans Administration. The ODA, or the Office of Degree Authorization, is responsible for ensuring the quality of in-state private colleges and out-of-state private and public higher education distance providers that offer programs to Oregon students. The VASA is responsible for the critical work of assuring that the programs approved for the training of veterans in Oregon are quality programs. And finally, our Private Career Schools Unit, our PCS, is responsible for ensuring the quality of private career schools in Oregon, which we have about 198 and just about covering every county in the state of Oregon. The four key functions of the ODA are to evaluate and approve degree programs at private, regulated, non-exempt colleges in our state. An example of ODA-regulated institutions are the University of Phoenix and Everest College. ODA-exempt institutions under ORS 348597 are longstanding, nonprofit, regionally accredited institutions such as Willamette University and Linfield. The ODA evaluates and approves distance degree programs offered to Oregonians by colleges and universities located outside our state. The ODA enforces laws against diploma mills and coordinates the implementation of SARA. SARA is a new program, as you know. It's a state authorization reciprocity agreement among member states. The Veterans Administration, state approving agency, or the VASA, is tasked with the contract with the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs and the responsibility of approving programs offered at public and private institutions in Oregon for those eligible for GI Bill education benefits. The VASA approves the programs, reviews facilities, conducts outreach, and serves as a liaison to the institution and to the GIs. VA-approved programs include our public universities and colleges and private colleges and universities in our state, vocational schools, and even high schools for a few limited cases relating to dependent benefits. Finally, our private career schools unit licenses and reviews of private career schools doing businesses in Oregon, and that includes some out-of-state institutions that are conducting marketing and recruitment in Oregon, but the facility is located outside the state. It also investigates in response to student complaints and provides significant technical assistance.
Juan, do these private career schools, do they have their main headquarters out-of-state, or are some of them here in-state?
Co-chair, members of the committee, most of the private career schools, and it's important to distinguish between the private career schools, which are certificate-granting institutions, versus the private colleges, which are degree-granting institutions. The vast majority of the private career schools in Oregon are locally owned and operated. There are a few that are subsidiaries, if you will, operating in Oregon of larger nationwide institutions.
Because you mentioned 198 mm-hmm. Career schools, mm-hmm. and so...
The majority are owned by Oregonians.
Okay.
People who reside in the state or investors who choose to be located in Oregon.
So mm-hmm. those student dollars are staying here in Oregon, not across the nation.
Yeah.
Senator Roblin.
So they would include things like training for truck drivers, training for other kinds of things. So there's a lot of different kinds of career training that are going on in the state, some of them big. Is that correct?
Senator Roblin, members of the committee, certainly the private career schools unit cover a large gamut of programs and services, from truck driving to nowadays, code writing for websites and programming, some security services for the internet. Also, beauty schools, a lot of the beauty schools that you see throughout our state. Some schools that prepare people for pharmacy technician type jobs or medical assistant jobs. You name it. Private career schools offer it. And it's very important for me to mention that both the ODA, the Office of Degree Authorization, and the Private Career Schools Unit have an extensive collaborative working relationship with Oregon licensing agencies that license the multiple occupations that we just discussed, and to make sure that the programs are well aligned with the professional standards and the requirements of those licensing agencies.
A follow-up. And you guys have done a lot of work lately on making sure that those colleges that are approved will be there in the future, and the money spent will be spent for those kids to get the education and the degrees that they have been promised. Is that not true? Part of the whole, all that group's work?
Senator Roblin, members of the committee, certainly a lot of our work is to ensure that those programs are solid, sustainable, quality programs. We've been conducting a great deal of reviews recently as to the financial stability of institutions and looking at situations where institutions may be at risk for not fulfilling their obligations to students, and certainly we're always looking at being prepared to take necessary measures that we have to our disposal under statutes and rules to enforce the guidelines and protect consumers, protect Oregonians.
I'm going to ask maybe an obvious question. So you have a practice of auditing any of these schools, and that may be a question that reflects the three of you here at the dais about how do you monitor the outcomes?
Co-chair comp, members of the committee, there's various different ways that we monitor the outcomes of the institutions. One of the things, for example, our private career schools annually have to renew their license. And so they have to submit to us some results in terms of students who participate in their programs, information about the students and how well the students did, and related information as to employment of the students. They also submit to us their financial statements. And those financial statements, we see whether or not there have been some changes, if they're making money or losing money, if there are any sort of situations or liabilities that we see that all of a sudden changed that may place that institution at risk. So it's a very hands-on, staff-intensive, I would say, process of reviewing each one of those institutions.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you get into things that might be a business model decision for the private career colleges? And I don't want to mention any particular one on the record, but at the same time want to be careful not to paint them all with a broad brush, because I think most of them are doing a great job providing a niche for educating and helping with that middle 40. But I know of one institution, and they have a nursing program, and they have the students come in and sign a contract, and the contract stipulates that anything in that contract is subject to change. And I had a daughter going through a program, and it was criminal, absolutely criminal. And the students couldn't say anything to anybody except Dad, who doesn't keep his mouth shut. But the students, I know of numerous situations where the students did say something, and after near completion of a two-year RN degree, they were kicked out of the school. They were reprimanded in ways that cost them greatly. Their grades were affected, so they were put back into another cohort and had to wait for a seat opening in the next cohort, and they could wait as much as a year waiting on a seat to get back in and finish the final term of their nursing degree. I mean, I could go on and on and on. It was just unbelievable, the stuff that was going on in that school. So I just wondered how deep you get into some of that stuff to make sure that everybody's being a good actor.
Right. Certainly appreciate the insight. Yeah, as a parent, and Representative Huffman, members of the committee, we the degree of how much we look into the operations of the schools does vary a little bit between the private career schools and the Office of Degree Authorization. So currently, and as you know, the origins of each one of them are into the heck from different agencies, so they have different bodies of law, different administrative rules, different ways in which they review the institutions and the requirements and the administrative rule guidelines they have for the institutions, and in fact our policy option package kind of gets us into talking about bringing some greater cohesion. So there is a little bit of difference. Now, what you describe is a situation where, for me, it would say that students always can and should have the ability to come to us and complain to our office and submit a complaint. It doesn't sound like that might have occurred. They might have done that with the institution.
when we do identify situations like that, we work to address those with the institution as to their practices. And if there are unfair practices, then we approach that, we investigate that. And sometimes, given the, and I'll give you an example between the differences of ODA and PCS, ODA reviews institutions on a biannual basis every 2 years, and PCS reviews them annually. So in a two-year period, can there be a change? Can there be a different way of operating that the institution chooses at the corporate level to make a change? They can, but they should be notifying us of changes. And if sometimes they fail, and if they fail to do that, then that could be a finding on our part and a reason for us to look a little bit deeper into the operations of the institution.
Follow. Yeah.
So how would a student, do you have a posting notification in the schools for students to know how to get you?
Representative Huffman, yes, members of the committee, in the catalog. In fact, one of the requirements that we have is that there should be a posting in their catalog and information that the school has that students can come to the Office of Degree Authorization. And if that's not there, and if they revise an addition and it's not evident, we'll be glad to follow up on a situation like that.
Just a final comment. I hope students can find that, because they're, at least my experience with this one school, some very egregious things going on.
Yeah.
My daughter got all of her prereqs done at Chemeketa, and of course it's very competitive to get into the nursing program, and so after two tries, you know, she ended up getting accepted into this one, and was told that, oh yeah, you can finish your two-year RN in less than 12 months because you're coming with all your prereqs, and they get you on the contract and make a bunch of promises and then continually pull the rug out from under you. 3 years later, and $40,000 of debt, she ended up with a nursing degree. And there was just, and as somebody that kind of knows people, and I mean, I was like, what do you do? I mean, you know, and she didn't want me to do anything because she was so vested at that point. She didn't want to rock the boat because she kept being told, oh, just one more term and you'll have your you'll be able to set for your NCLEX. And, oh, man, it was all I could do to, anyway.
Yes, Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Comp, and thank you, Representative Huffman, for bringing up this subject. A citizen, a student, came to my office and wanted to, was complaining about the occupational therapy two-year degree that's offered at one of our public community colleges, and it's an online program. Mm-hmm. It's relatively new, and I've learned that the state, from other sources, I've learned that the state is in great need of occupational therapists, and we only have only one private school offers the full degree. I don't know why we as a state are not offering the full degree. And there are public schools at a cheaper price. I don't know. There must be some reason to it, I assume. But apparently there's a great demand. It's one of the fastest growing health professions is occupational therapy, but as I've been told. But then with the two-year degree program, again, it's at one of the community colleges, and it's offered online, and it's relatively new. And just really bad reports of the professors being unprofessional and, you know, not, you know, giving being things like providing the syllabus on time and the structures of the class and the quality of the teaching being really low and just really not satisfied. And because I serve on this committee, of course, this person is, you know, this is what happens, you know. And so I understand what you're saying regarding the private schools, but this is one of our public two-year schools. And I wasn't necessarily going to mention it, but since Mr. Huffman got me all stirred up over here, or Representative Huffman, I thought I would.
Yes, we opened a door.
And so I, public school, at our public two-year schools, can you talk a little bit about the process? You don't know, you can address that specific situation, or you can just talk about what mechanisms are in place to make certain that when we're offering degrees, and especially if they're online, they still have to pay, and that the quality is there. So.
Representative Taylor, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, Ben Cannon. Each of the public colleges themselves have an institutional complaint process, so there is an opportunity or an avenue for students to bring complaints to the college that offers the program. CCWD, working with DHEC, also has under rule a complaint process that students can, you know, come to the state essentially to say that the program or their experience has in some way not been satisfying. I want to be careful not to overstate the amount of authority or latitude that the state of Oregon has to intervene. There are circumstances under which, with our publics, the state can get involved. But as you also know, the community colleges are locally governed. They're regionally accredited and program accredited. They have internal processes, and those will be the primary mechanisms through which students would see their complaints addressed. However, I should note that I would never discourage a student who has a concern about a community college from at least contacting the state, and there may be an opportunity to help. I do want to reinforce the fact that on the private side, where these colleges and career schools that Wands Group licenses, they have to get licensed by the state. And as he said, annually or biannually, and we have a great deal of authority and latitude, actually, on the private side around the ability to work with those institutions to address student complaints. I would actually suggest that our authority and latitude on the publics is somewhat more limited, interestingly. But we do have those mechanisms and certainly would never discourage, would encourage a student to come to us at the state if they have concerns.
Mm-hmm. I follow up. I'm sorry, but I that's great, and I understand that. It would be nice that would not be needed. I mean, I sound like I'm a million years old, but when I went to school, it never even occurred to me to complain because I was very happy with the quality of education I was receiving, and the idea that there is even a complaint about the ethics and the business practices and the quality of the education, it just would seem that we should be making certain that our standards are high enough that there wouldn't be a need for that's just how I see it. But I just wanted to say that. But so thank you.
Thank you. And we do need to move along.
Okay. Awesome. All right. Very quickly, our policy option package number 302 for the private post-secondary unit. And I would highlight that it's the proposal for this option package to be funded 100% with other funds from the fees collected. The request is for one additional position, an education program specialist 2 position. Adding this position will support our need to integrate regulatory structures and for program approval, compliance, and monitoring. And it will enhance the proactive steering, as we call it, of quality program options offered by private and out-of-state institutions, and ultimately the delivery of higher quality programs in support of Oregon's 40-40-20 goals. I'll be happy to answer any questions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. I think you pretty much got them.
Thank you.
And thank you, Juan. So I'm going to move on and spend a few minutes talking about the organization of this agency, or this agency in the making that you've been hearing about in bits and pieces over the last several weeks. We are proposing, through the governor's recommended budget, an integrated higher education coordinating commission agency. It's confusing. It is a commission. It is also the name of our sort of agency structure that combines functions that you've heard about, including Wands Unit, CCWD, our Office of University Coordination, our research and data functions, our Office of Student Access and Completion. Here's the sort of core of it, and these dollar figures on this slide within our budget request reflect primarily investments in our staffing. This is really sort of core agency investment. There's one line here, the CCWD numbers at $14.9 million sort of stick out. About $10 million of that is actually workforce investment that's in our CSL budget. It's not agency staffing. When you put this together and you look at our agency staff, and we'll show you some organizational charts in a few minutes, essentially it's about a about a $12 million general fund investment would reflect about 1% of the $1.7 billion that we propose putting into higher education and flowing through this structure. So that is essentially the administrative and support structure, about 1% of our total higher education budget. Just as a reminder, what the heck does and why we think there's value to a single sort of agency focused on student success in higher education. We are proposing to build an organization that really reflects these priorities. And I'd emphasize the extent to which these priorities are organized around student success, student completion, impact on students. Not institutional silos, as important as the institutions are. We're attempting to build an organization that's really designed to reflect priorities around student success. As I mentioned, we're proposing within this budget to organize and align our staff under these sort of major categories. We will create integrated units, so sort of non-siloed units for research, data, and operations, and we'll streamline the management and reporting systems across these offices.
Ben, are you located with Dr. Golden's office, or are you located in a different building?
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, a portion of our staff, including my office, is adjacent to Nancy's, to Dr. Golden's in the Somerville building here across the street. We also have staff in the public service building where community colleges and workforce development is located, CCWD, and some existing HEC staff are co-located there. Our Office of Student Access and Completion is in Eugene. And some of the research staff that we're proposing to inherit from the Oregon University system are also currently located in Eugene. So we're spread among Salem and Eugene, and will be at least for the short term. You've seen this again. Sort of our major offices, the first two on this, from looking from the left, our policy and operations and our research and data units really support the entire enterprise, and they're where we really begin the work of integrating these units that we've inherited from various other agencies. So that's where I think we'll see the first sort of initial payoff of finding some economies of scale and efficiencies, and looking at students sort of holistically through these offices. So I'm going to take each of the offices in turn and show you organizational charts. Won't spend a lot of time on these unless there are questions. But as you look at these charts, which, you know, we created this template. I like it. There's a lot of information on it. The darker colored positions are general fund positions. The lighter colored positions, the ones that just have dots in this slide, are primarily other fund or federal funded positions. So you begin to get a sense of the extent to which we're general fund or not general fund reliant in each of these agencies. Some of these positions are requested through POPs. Those have sort of dashed lines around them, are outlined in dash. So they're not existing positions. They're not in our CSL budget, but are reflected in some of our requests. This is really the infrastructure. This is our administrative infrastructure for the agency. It also includes our legislative and communications positions that support the entire operation. But this is where we really build an integrated administrative backbone for the agency: accounting, IT, HR, procurement, reporting. That's so we intend and propose to do that in a single shop supporting each of these offices that I'll go on to describe.
How does this compare to what we previously had in the chancellor's office, plus the some of the activities that you're describing down in Eugene?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. So one of the advantages of an integrated agency are the efficiencies that we can gain through an organization like this. So whereas OSAC, CCWD, the Chancellor's Office, and the HEC have each had to have HR functions, accounting functions, IT functions, we're proposing through this organization to consolidate those into a single entity. comparisons with the chancellor's office with what's come before, including the chancellor's office, are difficult because the chancellor's office had responsibilities that we don't, including for essentially the oversight and leadership of the public universities. We have a coordinating and a supporting function. We do have a certain amount of, I suppose you could call it, oversight, but not the governance responsibilities that the chancellor's office had. So whereas the chancellor's office, you know, they had over 120 FTE not very long ago. They will have zero FTE in the 15-17 biennium. We will inherit a few of those FTE. The rest are no longer on the state's books, but many of the functions that they performed for the chancellor's office have been shifted to campuses, and campuses have taken some of that staffing as a result. So it would be tempting to say that we've gone from 120 FTE to 4 in the HECS budget. That wouldn't be entirely accurate because of those other 116, and I'm using very rough numbers, certain amount of those have gone to campuses and to do their budget work, for example, or their fiscal work. So I want to be careful. Yes, we're getting a significant streamlining and consolidation on the one hand. The campuses, too, have had to do some staffing up in response to the dissolution of OUS.
Okay. Yes. I think maybe Co-Chair Monroe is going in the same direction I am, and if not, I'll pick it up after he's finished.
Okay. So the chancellor's office, essentially, and all those employees, has been replaced not just by HEC, but by the fact that they all have their own independent boards now and independent governance structure.
Senator Monroe, Madam Co-Chair, yes, that is correct. The functions of the chancellor's office, you could imagine them as being sort of parceled out, with some of them coming to the HEC. We've inherited their responsibilities for research and data for the system, for program approvals, for developing a budget to present to you, for dealing with the missions of the institutions, for a funding formula. So we have inherited some of those responsibilities. But the largest share of the chancellor's office actually performed administrative services, from risk management to accounting to payroll, back office functions, if you will. And those have been shifted to the campuses themselves. To be clear, the campuses have voluntarily in some cases under continuing requirements under law, are operating those in a shared way. But that's not a state-run shared service organization. It's really an institutional-run shared service organization. And much of the chancellor's office staff shifted to that shared service enterprise or to individual campuses.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 80, which hopefully you'll be seeing soon, is an attempt in the policy committee to take all of the statutory references to the chancellor's office and to the Board of Higher Education and integrate it into this system, including HEC. So we've been meeting before the session began and all through the session. The last stumbling block is who takes over the responsibilities for grants and loans and all of those kinds of things, and how do we parcel that out, and where do the funds go, and how do they get there, and all of that. So that's caused a little... We've been having the universities meeting with our legislative council to figure that out. We really want the treasurer to look over that as well. So that bill, if you want to watch Senate Bill 80, we will be having basically a hearing to move it to rules, because we don't think we can get all of that done. But it has been a big undertaking. HEC has been exceptional with respect to having people at all the meetings to figure where those are. And as you may know, there's some territorial issues at times with respect to where that goes. And so we've had to have conversations with the individual boards and the HEC and the legislature to figure out where's the best place to house whatever that responsibility. And it is not, I think they said there was 300 and some statutes that listed that have to be reconciled with the new structure. So it is ongoing, and you'll get to see the bill here shortly.
Thank you. And I have a question yet, and this might lead to Mr. McGee and Mr. Wilson. Now, I would love to think that the budget that used to be in the chancellor's office and supporting 100-plus employees. So is it something that is, can I accurately conclude that when Senator Monroe and I speak with the co-chairs, we say, well, there's this money that the community colleges and the universities are now taking responsibility for this work. They definitely need $550 million and $755 million because we no longer have this office that we're supporting. Is that a reasonable conclusion? Oh, you've got the answer, Senator.
I've got part of an answer. You mentioned community colleges and the university system. That community college used to be in higher in the State Board of Education, not in the high, Chancellor's office,
right,
and others. So as all those changes, you know, don't throw it all into one. So I just said it is more complex than just your question. But yes, there should be savings. I mean, I would expect,
well,
over time.
Some of us are trying to
be transferred,
trying to find about $40 million for CTE,
too.
And so we kind of have to dig in the minds of these old columns of these old structures. So
it's true.
Madam Co-Chair, I'm gonna go ahead and turn,
yeah,
to the next
please
office.
Please move, because we do want you to finish.
Yeah, this is the second, as do we. This is the second of the two really integrated HEC offices, our Office of Research and Data, and this is especially exciting. We've just hired its director, Patrick Crane, who you'll meet at some point, I'm sure, to lead up what we propose to be a unit that collects student-level data from colleges and universities, as we do today, separately in CCWD and at the Oregon University System, but to do it within a single office and to build a sort of common post-secondary student record system that can produce the kinds of reports and answers to the questions that you, the public, the institutions are interested in knowing about demographics, about completion, about enrollment, et cetera. So we propose, and we'll look at the package that would shift five positions from the Oregon University System, where they're actually under contract with the HEC today through some e-board action from the last biennium, but would shift those fully into the HEC to create a single integrated office for post-secondary research and data.
Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What a great confluence of timing that I was just able to get back from the Joint Tax Committee just when you're talking about the policy office or the research office. I think I had mentioned to you offline, but I wanted to get on the record that I am going to be requesting some information, perhaps as a test of your new integrated research office. No, I'm trying to because part of the question is indeed confirming that this is information that can now come out of the HEC as a place to get coordinated information about structurally of the seven universities and the 17 community colleges. And I'm going to go back and forth on specific details that I've been working with staff on. But I'm just trying to get both kind of a combination of like employees across the community colleges and the universities broken out by category, faculty, classified, non-classified, et cetera, over time. And we can kind of negotiate on what's an appropriate timeline to show some trends. And then also org charts for staffing-wise, for also all 7 and 17, that has all the levels of, whether it's campuses for the community colleges and universities, and different levels of admin, all of the presidents, vice presidents, associate, assistant, you know, VPs, provosts, et cetera, kind of as much, as thorough a breakout of that as possible. And I'm sure you can have that by Monday. Just kidding. But I am just trying to get to a sense of, you know, part of, as we all keep digging into the higher costs and the way to make sure that we can that our state contribution can be maximized is to try to get a sense of how that is developing. And I know we talk a lot about the shift from full-time to part-time, but I think there's a whole other conversation to be had about teaching versus not teaching, you know, and kind of admin versus direct student services. So I will appreciate working with you and the Office of Research and Data. to get that information.
Representative Smith-Borner, Madam Co-Chair, we look forward to working with you on the request. Happy to do so.
Thank you.
This is our Office of Student Access and Completion. This was, you know it as OSAC. It was renamed and put under the HECS reporting structure in the last biennium. This essentially reflects its current organization, but there are some positions requested within the budget associated with our Aspire program and our FAFSA outreach program. These are not, when we look at when you look at the POPs here, these are actually federally funded. We propose for these to be federally funded expansion through the College Access Challenge Grant that we expect to receive from the feds in the coming biennium. Again, a mix of general funds and non-general funds within this agency doing important work to expand opportunities, access, and completion for Oregon students. CCWD, this is a complicated unit within the organization that has, of course, a number of initiatives and responsibilities. The right-hand side of the page reflects its connections to and responsibilities for workforce activities in the state, primarily federally funded workforce programs. You do see a couple of columns of dark blue positions that are requested within the workforce packages that Lisa Neisenfeld and Karen Hummelbaugh described to you related to youth employment and incumbent worker training. Those would be new federally or new general fund investments. The left-hand side of the page, our education division and our adult basic skills unit, both the latter of which is also primarily federally funded through Title II of the Workforce Investment Act, or whatever it becomes, whatever title it is under the new Workforce Investment and Opportunity Act. So, again, an important part of the HECS organizational structure. What we've done that's different here is shift the operations unit, the accounting, the IT, the payroll and procurement out and moved it into this integrated, streamlined agency-wide operation unit in order to gain some of those benefits of integration there. We have an Office of University Coordination. You've heard from Brian Fox, who leads up the Budget and Finance unit on the right-hand side and Salam Noor, who leads up the Academic Strategies on the left-hand side. So a total of five positions reporting to them that are general funded that do that work with our universities. This is really essentially what we've inherited from the Oregon University system, along with those research and data positions that I mentioned earlier. And finally, Juan's unit that you just heard him describe and its responsibilities for the Office of Degree Authorization, private career schools, and authorizing institutions for veterans benefits, our state authorization responsibility under federal contract. Again, this is an entirely other funded, both fee and federal contract funded unit. When Whitney Grubbs was here from the governor's office, she described this policy option package, the Center for Community Innovation. This would be entirely general funded and entirely new for your consideration. I'll run quickly through our POPs and then wrap up and turn it over to Bill for the final conclusion. POP 100 is a big one because it essentially transfers the funds for CCWD and OSAC, OHSU debt service, and appropriations to colleges and universities into the HECS budget. So it's and if there are questions, I'm sure Bob or Doug can help with this, but it's essentially a transfer package to help create the structure that I've described. POP 301 is our management streamlining and organizational need package. Again, this is helps to this is about a $300,000 general fund package. It has both savings and some new costs, but it helps to create this organizational structure, including the co-locating our administrative back office functions for IT, budget, accounting, payroll, and HR. And again, the costs of that are largely offset by savings that we realize through the proposed merger. our described our integrated research and data team. The price tag on this will look like 1.4 million above the CSL. However, that reflects essentially a biennialization of dollars that were appropriated out of the OUS budget in the last, or were transferred out of the Oregon University System Chancellor's Office budget in the last biennium, to ensure that the HEC could contract back to OUS for research and data functions during the last year. So this, while it's not in CSL, would maintain and biennialize sort of ongoing opportunities for the HEC to perform its data maintenance responsibilities, its reporting responsibilities for the public universities. Post-secondary association memberships, POP 304, this will be a sort of zero impact over CSL. So I'm tempted to say it's a freebie. That would sound make it sound maybe too easy, but it is essentially a responsibility that we inherit from the Chancellor's office to ensure that the state can continue to gain the advantages of being a member of the Western Interstate Commission on Higher Education, WICHE. That's where the majority of the dues associated with our memberships go. There are also there are a few dollars in here for our the state's membership in Education Commission of the States and the State Higher Education Executive Officers Association. And really, this is accomplished through transfers from dollars that were previously appropriated to the Chancellor's Office and the Oregon University System. A couple of key infrastructure POPs for our organization. This CCWD work reconciliation package, POP 311, begins to sort of right-size CCWD and align the funding streams to the work. If you noticed on the org chart when I showed CCWD, if you ignored the new positions, there are practically no general funds in CCWD anymore. I may be overstating that slightly. I think there are about eight FTE were in CCWD general funds for this current biennium, 13-15. That meant that we were primarily required at CCWD, we've primarily been required to focus our work on that, which is federally funded. This package would ensure that CCWD can begin to provide the level of support and leadership for community colleges using some general funds. It's a total cost of about $1 million that they need and deserve, and I think that you expect. So it would begin to right-size CCWD, not through adding positions, but through making them able to, freeing up some of the positions to do the kind of work that they're expected to do through some fund shifts there. Our Office of Student Access and Completion receives, as you've heard previously, receives FAFSA information. That's core private student-level information on every filer within the state of Oregon. It requires a pretty significant IT infrastructure to maintain that repository. It requires high levels of security, stability, and durability, and this is an agency that has not received in the past sort of sufficient funding to build in the kind of annual maintenance that should be performed for our critical IT systems. This package which costs about $1 million. We're still working on the business case to be able to come up with final numbers, but we're holding or requesting that we hold $1 million for this in order to replace the agency's financial management system in order to support the continued maintenance of those vital student records. Just some concluding remarks. So the past 16 days of presentation reflect the first time that this legislature has heard an integrated higher education budget request. We've not done this before, bring all of our higher education work together under a single umbrella and present it to you in a coordinated and integrated way. And for our part, for the commission's part, we've tried to illustrate some of the key trends and data points in order to help you with the very important and difficult decisions you have to make relative to budget. I hope you've seen that our focus is primarily on student outcomes. That's we've tried to reflect that at the start, at the finish. That's where we're focused, and that's reflected in how we've designed this and our budget requests. And it's I think that focus on students at the putting them at the center is particularly important given the way that students experience higher education today, which isn't as it was so much in the past by going to enrolling in an institution, completing at the institution, and moving on, but by experiencing higher education through multiple institutions. We have, as I've said before, the majority of our Oregon Public University students who graduated with a BA last year began at a community college. This transfer question is so vital. We've heard about the role of the privates, and we know that connections to and with workforce are important. So really putting students at the center has been key. I think it's reasonable to ask, for you to ask, as I think you've done throughout these weeks, sort of what's it going to take to get to our very ambitious goals? And that's really the foremost question for our commission. What's it going to take? And I'm just going to make 4 points on that, two of which maybe larger issues than our commission, but I think they're worth noting. And then the final two that really I think are squarely in front of us and you. But the first two, one is it's going to take improved levels of high school completion and college readiness. There's just absolutely no question that 40-40-20 requires and depends on significantly improved levels of high school completion and college readiness. The second is that it's going to take significantly more funding for higher education in Oregon. We cannot meet the nation's most ambitious goals for educational achievement beyond high school by being 47th in how we fund higher education. Those two points are simply not reconcilable. We think we can do better than we are doing today, but being 47th when it comes to state investment in higher education is not commensurate with having the nation's most or nearly most aggressive goals for college completion and success. But the primary focus of our commission, I guess where we have really invested our energies, is to say, well, we don't control, the HEC doesn't decide sort of how much money will be invested in higher education, although we certainly can advocate and encourage you and Oregonians to do more. But we have a responsibility for helping identify for you and for other legislators what the priorities ought to be from within that appropriation, whatever it is. We want and need to do more for all, but our resources are, of course, limited. And so the budget that we've presented to you over the last 4 weeks reflects the commission's best thinking around the priorities. And if you look carefully at our budget request, we didn't simply request across the board equal sized increases, proportional increases for each of these funding streams. The commission spent a lot of time trying to be strategic about where those recommendations were focused. That's a very difficult thing to do. I think you all know that as well as anyone, because the claims on the dollars are so compelling and so needed in each and every one of the types of institutions and students that you help to fund. But the commission's priorities really came down to two, and so these are the sort of final 2 points. One is affordability, and you've heard that over and over and over again from students, from faculty, from administrators, from community members, from businesses. Higher education affordability has to be addressed, and I'm going to say more about that in a minute, but let me touch on the other one. The other is completion rates. We have to succeed with more of our students have to succeed, and you know, we've talked about those rates. We've provided them to you at a number of points, and so I'll also address that. But first, on affordability, there are a variety of ways to improve affordability. All of them require more money. We don't have as much money as we need. So where do you focus it? Well, the commission's conclusion was to focus the largest proportional increases in our state's targeted need-based grant, the Oregon Opportunity Grant. It focuses the dollars on the student, provides the lowest income students, the students who have the greatest need, with the funding. And that was a sort of difficult conclusion for the institution, for the commission to reach, but that's what it did. It said that's where we should focus our primary our largest increases within our budgets, and that's, you know, it won't solve the affordability issue, but it will provide targeted help where it's most needed. The second, so moving on to completion rates, the commission concluded, in order to move those rates, in order to help institutions and students ensure that more than 60% of our Oregon University students complete a degree within 6 years, and more community college students who enroll succeed in certificates or degrees or transitions to college to 4 years or to the workforce, we do need to increase institutional funding. That's highly important. And we need to provide incentives and rewards and supports for the institutions with your state dollar to focus those resources on student support, on the things that help them to complete. And the HEC has responsibility for that funding distribution, and we're working on those changes. We've described them to you in brief here, and we'll be happy to come back and talk about the work that we're doing to create those kinds of supports and incentives for institutions to really focus your investment on student success. We still have a long way to go. I think these are this is a promising start. The co-chair's budget, your work to get additional resources is promising and hopeful for higher education in Oregon. As an agency, we're still getting our feet under us. I think the presentation and this organizational design certainly reflects that we're in the early stages of thinking about higher education in a coordinated and student-focused way. It's a complex undertaking to integrate the units that we're trying to bring together to do so effectively. We're very fortunate to have extraordinary staff. I just want to thank those who are most responsible for the work that we brought forward over the last few weeks. The directors of our offices, Bob Brew at the Office of Student Access and Completion, Jim Middleton at CCWD, who's been supported by Krissa and the rest of the team there, Juan Baez Arevalo, who you just heard from, Patrick Crane, our new director of data and research, Dave Zerbe, who will lead up our operations unit, Salam Noor and Brian Fox, working on the universities. And then, Dana Richardson, who's really been masterful in helping pull all this together, and Di Hartigan, our communications person, who put together these slides, and Cheryl Myers, our chief of staff, who has helped really coordinate this entire effort. And finally, I want to thank the institutions, because we did this in partnership, which was itself an experiment. We gave days to them. We worked with them on those days to try to provide you not only with a sense of what the state's agency responsibilities were, but what they're doing with the dollars, the hundreds of millions of dollars that you invest. I think the efforts of the universities and colleges to bring that information forward in compelling ways helped really enrich the presentation. Finally, our commission, 12 of the 14 members are pictured here, is always on our mind and is responsible for the strategic focus that you see reflected in the presentation that we brought forward. So appreciate the time. It's been a great opportunity for us as a team, as an organization, to figure out who we are, what we're about, and present that to you. So thank you.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Congratulations to you and Dr. Ray and Brian in the Capitol construction recently. I was kind of curious how the presentation was going to look and differ this year, because, you know, we used to get the individual universities coming in and making their own pitch, and Jay Kenton would come up, you know. I knew it was going to be different, but I thought it went well, and I've circled back around with some of the institutions, and they felt really good about the presentation also. So I wanted to throw that out. May I make a comment about an experience I had after the public testimony University Day? I think that was Tuesday.
Yes, sir.
It was also OSU Day in the building, and so in the afternoon I met with quite a substantial group of OSU students, and several of them had been in the hearing room that morning, and at least one, if not more, of my folks from Central Oregon, OSU Cascades, had testified. And I said, you know, we didn't have time for comments on the record that day, but I just wanted to kind of follow up with several of you to bring a different perspective, because all these guys were 20-ish, 21, you know, and not a lot of life experience under their belt. But I said, first of all, I want to tell you I'm supportive of the 755. I'm supportive of keeping tuition down. I'm supportive of minimal student debt. I really am. And my voting record shows that I've supported that consistently. But I said, I just want to bring a different perspective. When you graduated from high school, your goal was probably to, at some point, to go on to college. And somewhere along the lines, you have agreed to accept, largely we heard, $30,000 to $35,000 in student debt was the testimony of a lot of them. I said, but I want you to remember, some of your classmates that graduated from high school and got a diploma also decided to go out and borrow $30,000 to $35,000 to go into business and put their entrepreneurial spirit to work. So I said, should state government create a program where we have a business opportunity grant where we help support somebody wanting to go into business? We don't do that particularly. I mean, Business Oregon does have some programs, and there is some assistance out there. So I said, I want you to think about that. You know, they're investing in a career, a future, a lifestyle. You're investing in a career, a future, a lifestyle, a job. So, and I said, the other thing, too, is to keep in mind, you had some good comments about your student debt this morning, and you've given it a lot of thought, and you've got some anxiety over it. But I said, I also want to remind you that within a few years, most of you are going to be in a car dealership not thinking twice about signing on the bottom line for a contract for a $35,000 car. And every one of the students were like, wow, really appreciate that. That's true. There. You know, so we just all have to put it into perspective, do the best we can. But anyway, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Springer, and then we need to go to Mr. McGee.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I appreciate the emphasis placed on increasing the opportunity grant. I think that's key. Let's not forget middle-income folks also, because they get very little support. I'll just leave it at that. But the other point I want to make is we're seeing over and over and over that students are typically taking 12 credits, not 15 credits, because of financial aid. I would love to see, and I know some colleges are doing that, I know one community college in particular doing this. I think we need to look at ways to support those other three credits at least to get them to 15, because you will not graduate in 4 years if you're taking 12 credits.
Yeah.
You will not.
Yeah.
So we need to look at a way to create, because federal financial aid is based on the 12. Until we do that, I think we're spinning our wheels. I really do. So we need to look at a way to get students into 15 credits minimum. And that said, we need to look at a way to not only make sure they know they need to do that, but number two, the those that are attempting that maybe have some incentive to do that. Thank you.
Mr. McGee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Bring us home.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bill McGee, the Department of Administrative Services. Just want to take a couple of minutes to do a review of the governor's budget process and let you know how it was developed and sort of kind of review the key pieces you've seen. The context, you know, here is it's the 10-year vision for the state, the educational goals of increasing skills and knowledge to the modern economy. the statutory specific goal of getting to the 40-40-20 levels within 10 years. Certainly the equity lens focus on removing the achievement gap. And within the Oregon Education Investment Board Pathways Framework, the HEC budget specifically focused on the last two, as Ben's indicated, the high school and completing and college completion and connection of careers to education. Again, you've heard this, the priorities of the budget were the affordability, the redesign and expansion of the Opportunity Grant Program, the continuation of the tuition buy-down from last biennium, institutional support for both the community colleges and the universities, the move to an outcome-based funding formula to allocate those institutional support funds to actually begin to look at degree and completion, certificate and completion, and to address capacity in the budget for 13 additional university capital construction projects. Other priorities, the workforce development packages you've heard about, the youth employment and the incumbent worker program, and existing programs are a little bit refocused. The community programs, the governor's office talked to you about, the creation of the Community Leverage Center and the Community Leverage Fund as well. And finally, really Ben's focus today was on the infrastructure of the agency. It's bringing the existing HEC, OSAC, CCWD, together as a unit and shifting the funding allocation from DAS to HEC and tying the control of the funding to where the outcome-based foreign funding will be located. This is just gives you a little history of what the combined agencies would have looked like had they existed in 11-13, the actual expenditures, the 13-15 LAB, and then the governor's budget for 15-17. The one thing I'd draw your attention here is most of the conversation you've had is really focused on the general and lottery fund packages and programs for obvious reasons. Of the about $1.9 billion in this budget, proposed budget, about $190 million is other funds and federal funds. Most of that is the workforce money we've talked about, the private scholarships through the student access program. There's some debt service on the legacy OHSU bonds for the Opportunity Program that's paid with Master Tobacco Mentalist funds. And there's some various smaller pieces, fee revenues for the GED program and the private career schools and degree authorization programs. Most of the money, as you know, goes out the door. This is primarily an agency that will be sending money to students, to institutions, to local workforce investment boards. There is really a very small budget for actually managing the institutions itself. And there's, of course, as we've talked about before, a significant debt service payment that goes out for the projects that have already been approved. This doesn't include any projections of debt service for whatever new projects you might approve. In terms of the other funds and federal funds, there are a couple of issues you'll probably see more likely when you get to work session. The governor's budget transfers Special Employment Department Administrative Funds, or CDAF funds, that's a federally approved diversion of the UI tax to support the workforce programs you've talked about and a portion of the Community and the Innovation Fund. For the degree authorization and private career school programs, you will see a couple of fee bills. One will be an increase in fees, Senate Bill 218, that either is on its way or you already have. And there's also a fee ratification bill, House Bill 5025, for fees that were increased administratively during the current biennium that you have to ratify for those to go forward. And then finally, bond proceeds for the university projects at this point historically have not shown in the budget in the last couple of bienniums since the status changed. They've been in the bond bill and there hasn't been a limitation attached to that. We're in discussions that may need to change as we go forward for a variety of various reasons. I think that's partly what Senator Robin's committee has been talking about as well. We had a couple of minor changes, technical changes. There was an error in the budget that we have to shift $4.8 million for the Public University Support Fund to the OHSU Support Fund just to create a technical error that we got in at the end of the year. A couple of capital construction projects for OIT need to be consolidated rather than produced separately, and then there are a few other just very minor technical things. Finally, we were asked to give you an overview of the comparison of the governor's budget from the co-chair's framework. You know this already, the Public Unity Support Fund in the co-chair's chamber of 635 was $46 million, larger than the governor's budget after the correction I just mentioned. The co-chairs indicated potential another $15 million, depending on the revenue forecast or availability of other funds. The co-chairs are $35 million higher than the governor at the published 535 number. Again, a potential another $15 million on the revenue forecast. Opportunity grant is $5 million lower than the governor proposed. Co-chairs identified the possibility another $5 million, depending on the revenue forecast. And then finally, the co-chairs have restored the $8 million to the Sports Action Lottery program that the governor had proposed shifting to opportunity grants. So that's a quick overview.
Thank you. Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to, if I could request, Bill, that slide. Could you send us a corrected version with the numbers in that pie chart slide?
This, the one on the screen didn't have the numbers.
On this one?
Yeah, it just says value and percentage rather than the actual.
Oh, could you,
yeah.
Sorry, yes.
No, it's okay. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Thanks.
Thank you, Will.
Briefly, Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bill, you had pointed out the $8 million sports lottery being restored, but based on previous percentages, wouldn't the sports lottery actually be greater than $8 million historically?
Co-Chair Reverend Huffman, the revenue forecast is about, I think, $11.3 million. In the last couple of bienniums, the legislature has capped the distribution of sports action. $8 million was the cap that exists in the current biennium. I would ask Mr. Wilson probably to discuss the co-chair's intent on that, but you're correct that under the statutory provision that 1% of gross of net lottery proceeds is transferred to sports action, that would be a reduction from what the projection.
That's what I was thinking.
Okay.
Madam Chair, just to wrap up here on HEC, and to keep it short given the time, just want to remember, and it's our role to be the downer at the end of the meeting often, I guess, is that many of the policy packages and around the infrastructure, IT projects, and some of those other things are not necessarily included in the co-chair's budget, so those have to be carved out in some way to fund. We're working on that, and we'll bring that to you during work session and other discussions. So just keep that in mind. While some of the big things are set in the co-chair's budget was never at the detail to dive down into the smaller things. And just a reminder on schedule, Monday will be OEIB, will include public testimony. If we need to, as a subcommittee, Tuesday is also OAIB. It may not be necessary. Then that be a day off. And then Wednesday of next week is the continuation and completion of the public testimony on public universities. And then Thursday we'll start some work sessions on the licensing boards.
Okay. And Co-Chair Monroe?
Yeah, and when we get into OEIB, are we going to, among other things, look at the proposal that Senator Roblin's group worked up?
Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, I would guess that'd be a phase two discussion because the OEIB is not scheduled for very long at the phase one, so I think that'd be a phase two discussion. I still think they're working on that to a certain extent.
Well,
also,
yeah,
those bills went to the rules.
Consideration and angst about a lot of it, and I just wanted to make sure this committee understood what was being proposed and what the justification for that is, and whether or not we agree with it.
And do we have community meetings today or this weekend?
I believe they are tomorrow.
And
or is there one tonight?
There's one at Mountain Community College
tonight. Yes.
Mountain Community College at 7 o'clock.
Yes.
Okay. You need to know how to get there. Just follow Senator Monroe, I think.
Right.
I've been there a few times.
Right. And we wish our senators a nice 3-day weekend after that. And the House.
We'll be doing the work of the people.
Well, I know you're following him, but we'll see.
Through the weekend.
Stop. That we may well be working tomorrow as normal, but I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5024. Committee, thank you. Thank you to Mr. Cannon. What we have been seeing in the last 2 weeks was a dream of many of us from 4 to 6 years ago, and all good things take time, and yes, your staff is moving it along, and yeah, just deep appreciation. And we are adjourned. On to our next meetings.
So
on to our next meetings.